Hi, this is Bill Forster.
And this is Jim Sorensen.
You are listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
You're listening to All Things Transformers, version 2.0.
For some strange reason, I want to say that's Jim and his hetero life mate, Silent Bill.
That's pretty much how it works, yeah.
I'm extremely secure in my masculinity, so go ahead.
Right ahead. I'm completely secure in my silentness.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to All Things Transformers. I am one of your hosts, TFGN Mike. Joining me is Pecan Court Michael. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. And in this latest All Things Transformers / TFG1 / TFG2 interview, we welcome the writers and artists Jim Sorensen and Bill Forster. Hey guys, how's it going?
Hi, how are you? I thought this
going
was
great. Talks.
You thought it was what?
TED Talks.
That was a TED. We're lacking the stage.
Oh, okay.
Yes. No staging.
We don't have the big, huge TED stage here, although that would be cool.
I actually do. Is this not a video interview?
No, it's not.
Damn it! I paid so much to rent this.
Jim lives on a stage.
Nice.
Yeah, I could kind of see that. He lives on a stage inside the Ark. All right, so coming up, I believe it's in June, you guys are releasing Transformers Legacy, The Art of Transformers Packaging, correct?
Oh, this is the first I'm hearing of it.
Funny, I just want to make sure I have the date right.
We're actually not 100% sure of the date. The last we'd heard was April 30th, but I believe that's getting pushed back a little bit. I think that the plan is to try and get it out certainly before Age of Extinction.
Yeah, according to the TF Wiki, it says May 6th, but that could be, you know, could be incorrect. Who knows?
I would think they would know more than we would know.
Yeah.
Those guys who know are updating the wiki, so.
Yes.
I assume they have a source for their info, but I think it might get pushed back a little bit.
Yeah, it'd be fine if it got pushed back like a week or two before the movie.
That would be great for us, kinda, actually.
Kind of makes sense.
Yeah. You'd actually get some publicity that way. I mean, you know, anytime someone went to go review the movie or talk about the movie or the movie came up somewhere, it would say, oh, also, there's a supplemental material being released. Go buy that.
Yeah, because yes, that's going to...
It could happen. You never know. If I were writing it, I would totally put it in there.
Or you could say, if you didn't like the movie, here, go read this. It's better.
Right. If Michael Bay did horrible things to your childhood, maybe you should revisit your childhood in the way of Legacy.
I got to say, I never quite understood the idea that Michael Bay is doing bad things to our childhood in that, as far as I can tell, all the G1 stuff still exists and is still out there. And it's actually probably easier to find now than it was in, like, I don't know, 1997 or so. So I can get people not enjoying it. I don't quite get the, you know, that you're ruining my childhood. It's like, well, unless he has a time machine, I just don't quite see intellectually how he can do that. And I tend to think that if he did have a time machine, he'd probably use it for other things, like ruining Casablanca or something.
Well, you know, I will say that as the movies have progressed and Michael Bay is still in the director's seat, that he has slowly been paying attention to fans, because at least with Dark of the Moon and now Age of Extinction, we have a lot more G1 influence in the films in certain places.
How about that? I think the fear is that Michael Bay is trying to replace the things that you loved in your childhood with his own stuff. And the fact of the matter is that he can't really replace your childhood. He's replacing your child's childhood. Well, my kids, you know, only know who G1 Optimus Prime is because I shove it down their throat. They're immersed in others in the current culture.
Yeah.
But like him or not, he's still bringing in more fans and more money into the
Yeah.
You know, I've been having this debate over on the G.I. Joe forums because, you know, Bill and I did a couple of the Joe books, and it sort of reignited my interest in G.I. Joe. I'd liked it as a kid, but it wasn't something I stayed with as a fan as an adult. And one of the things that, at least I believe, G.I. Joe is sort of lacking is their version of Beast Wars. And if I can explain what I mean, you know, Transformers came in 1984 and it was brilliant and it was the hot toy for 2-3 years, and the movie was a little disappointing by movie standards, but it certainly changed the trajectory of the show and the toy line, and it sort of faded away. It drifted into concepts like Pretenders and Action Masters and then left U.S. shelves altogether. And Hasbro waited a couple of years and then tried to revive it under Generation 2. And I think as a toy line, from a fan perspective, was actually very successful at reviving the toy line. It was quite good, I think, at taking some of the classic characters and reinventing them with much better toys, I think, objectively, than a lot of what we'd had in G1. But it wasn't a big commercial success, and it wasn't a big creative success in terms of there wasn't much fiction to support it. There was a little bit in the comic front. There was the TV show that was the old show repackaged. And then Beast Wars came along. And then I have an article about this in the Transformers Collectors Club that's going to be out next month. But it sort of proved that Transformers could be not just Generation 1, not just cars and trucks versus jets and tape cassettes. It proved that it could not necessarily be Autobots and Decepticons. And I think it was so strong. It was such a strong toy line. It was such a strong cartoon. You know, the characters are so vivid. The storylines were so well produced that I think despite itself, the sort of nascent Transformers fandom had to accept that this existed and was quite good and was a legitimate part of the Transformers franchise. And ever since then, Transformers has rebooted itself every 3 to 5 years or so, sometimes with a couple of soft reboots in between, sometimes not. And we as fans sort of have been conditioned to accept that Transformers can do that, can sometimes be very different, can sometimes be, you know, the mirror universe, can sometimes be based around minicons or the concept of power linking, can sometimes be Optimus as a young, inexperienced commander with a new art style. It can sometimes be very kid-focused. It can sometimes be very sort of adolescent-focused with lots of explosions and boobs. And they're all sort of valid expressions of the Transformers brand. And I think that Beast Wars really did that. And I think that Joe, which is where I started with this, for the most part hasn't had that. If you want to get technical, it sort of has had that in that there was the 12-inch Joes for a long time, and then Hasbro reinvented it quite radically as the 3¾-inch line of Real American Hero. But I think since that, they haven't been able to. And I think it's because Real American Hero hasn't really had its Beast Wars. You know, they've tried little reboots, things like G.I. Joe Extreme and Sigma 6 and even Renegades, but it's never really gotten that far away from the Real American Hero concept in a way that succeeded. And I think until they do, it's going to be hard, which is why on the G.I. Joe 50th anniversary this year, you know, Hasbro isn't doing very much at all, whereas the Transformers 30th anniversary, they're celebrating with books and toys and media and even a gigantic tome of Transformers box art, which is what we're here to discuss.
Yes.
Exactly. You see how I did that? I'm good.
Yes.
Came
yes.
right yes, around, you are. Right back to the beginning. I was going to say we should totally have Jim on our Transformers retrospective because he knows stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we could.
We Let's talk about this after the show.
Yes.
Say.
So, Jim, how about me and you reboot G.I. Joe then? And that'll give you our next project.
If Hasbro's willing to let us do it.
Okay.
To the G.I. Joe Adventure Team roots, we wouldn't call it that because I don't think that's a super marketable name in the 21st century, but kind of go back to those roots and maybe have the villains don't use the name, but the villains kind of be this sort of Cobra Law secret society of monsters, get away from terrorists and get into sort of more of the supernatural and super science. I think that might be a lot of fun.
All right, let's do it.
Okay.
I would watch that. Yeah.
There you go.
You got to keep the tanks, though. Tanks versus monsters would be cool.
I think that, and I know this is pretty far afield from a Transformers book of box art, but to me, the core of what makes G.I. Joe G.I. Joe is the idea of action figures interacting with vehicles. Because I think G.I. Joe has been many things over the years, but that's always been an important element, the important element. That's sort of what it's all about. And I think that, you know, the military theme stuff, the heavy military theme stuff, it hasn't been selling recently. And I don't think you necessarily have to be married to that. I think you might want to nod to the sort of concept and origins, but move away from it a little bit.
Well, you know, what was to blame for that is Obama's manless drones.
Actually, I think that some of the most popular G.I. Joe vehicles were the ones that could never actually exist.
Do you think so? Like what?
Oh, yeah. Oh, like Destro's Dominator.
That was a fun one.
You can never build that in real life, but it's and really cool.
Sometimes G.I. Joe is very much about realistic vehicles, but sometimes it's very much about the sort of the fantasy and the sci-fi. I mean, there have been lines of G.I. Joe that have been about, you know, the eco-warrior type stuff. There have been lines that have, you know, they're fighting zombies in the club this year for the G.I. Joe Con, which I think is I do think zombies are quite overplayed, but in this context, I think it's a lot of fun.
Well, the neat thing is, though, is during the same time that Transformers was having their G2, where everything was very strangely colored, Dayglow, if you will, G.I. Joe was having the same, I don't want to say the same design pattern, but they were also very Dayglow color and very different, and they were using different themes like, let's try ninjas, or let's try Echo Warriors, or let's try, you know, just different gimmicks. And now you see those coming full circle. Like, wow, what did they do? You know, we got Echo Warriors. Well, what does Echo Warriors fight? Zombies. Sure, why not? Zombies are popular.
Kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I was honestly expecting something like Cobra Law to be vampires. And we'll have vampires. Sure, G.I. Joe versus vampires. That would rock.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think that might be certainly a good direction to explore, even if only to just prove to the – you'd have to do it well. You'd need really good toys, and you'd need a really good show. Get, like, Marty Eisenberg to write it because I think that guy kicks ass. I thought Renegades was really good. Renegades might have been enough of a reboot if there was – you know, enough sort of momentum behind it. I would have really loved to have seen a second season of that, and I would have loved if the toys had been able to get out on shelves in time to sort of have the virtuous cycle, the toys supporting the show supporting the toys. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that was a fun concept.
Yeah, but that didn't happen because of that movie.
I don't...
Any time a movie comes up, oh, let's cancel everything else and promote the movie.
Yeah, well, that's a shame, because I think G.I. Joe could handle two lines, you know, one for collectors and one for movie. We see that time and time again with Transformers too.
Not to be too cynical, but I'm not sure G.I. Joe can support one line right now, or at least Hasbro seems to have their doubts.
I feel that at least in that line and that franchise, I think they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot a little bit. But
Well, they are, but let's face it, G.I. Joe are just the upgraded version of the old Green Army men we all grew up playing with. All right, let's get back to the questions here. Jim, where did you grow up?
I grew up in North Babylon, New York.
Wow.
Sorry, it's not a very open-ended question.
What about you, Bill?
I grew up in Queens, New York, and then I moved out to Bayshore, Long Island, which is where I met Jim. We kind of grew up on the island together.
Yeah.
Oh, really? So you guys have been friends a long time.
Since I was about 17 and he was 15, I believe.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah. So over 20 years, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just while we're on the subject, my wife, Ming Lee, she's from Taiwan originally, but she grew up in Bayshore as well.
Yeah, we actually went to the same high school, me and his wife.
Oh, cool. Interesting. That's something I never knew.
here's a slightly funny story about that. I don't think Bill was there, but we had another friend whose sister was in the same class as Ming Lee, my wife, and she was the valedictorian of her home school that year. So my friend actually... And I met her at college, so a few months after she gave her valedictorian speech. So actually, one of my best friends growing up had seen her and heard her give a speech about 4 months before I met her and started dating her.
Ah. So that must have been a nice icebreaker.
He's like, oh, I remember her. Yeah, a quarter of her speech was in Chinese. I couldn't understand a word.
That must have been rough. So when you guys were friends... In high school, was that like your dream and aspiration to be writers or illustrators?
Well, I think I always wanted to be an artist, and I eventually went to art school, and I wound up being the art director of a museum in New York. I don't know what Jim's goals were, but it wasn't really our plan to do books together now.
No, and I got to say, the writing was something that came a little bit later. I was more interested in science when I was in high school and college. I studied applied mathematics, and I worked for years in consulting.
Mm-hmm. Jim's like a super brain computer in a jar.
Well, what had happened was I was always interested in Transformers, and I found the Transformers fan community online in about 94. Alt Toys, Transformers was pretty much where all of it happened at the time. I mean, the web barely existed at the time. And I started conversing and eventually started contributing. I think the first sort of real contribution, aside from just debate, to the fan club was that, not fan club, the fandom, was that I had cracked the Beast Wars language, like a cryptoquote, and figured out what all the symbols meant, and eventually posted that as TrueType fonts online. So that was about 1997, 98. That
was
so
you.
That was me. Yeah. You could figure out what all the hidden messages were, and some of them were just things like shields are failing, and they would say shield failure. But then sometimes it would be, the computer saying it's been a long time since I've had sweet thistle pie, stuff like that. Including one in Beast Machines. The Beast Machines didn't have a lot, but there's one in Beast Machines that I think was directed at me personally, which was, if you can read this, seek help. I've been posting translations online for years.
Skier has that kind of sense of humor, I think.
Well, presumably that would have been done by the production department.
Yeah, by the artist. Kind of, yeah,
that's true.
I remember when the translations first started, appearing online, and I was like, "Wow, that is really cool." And I just assumed that somebody in the art department leaked it. I didn't realize that like some weird cryptographer was decoding all this stuff.
It's actually not that hard. And then the reason I mentioned shield failure was because that was the first sort of clue that something was going on with the language to me. I was watching the show. I had the Laserdisc. I picked them up in Japan. I was living in Japan at the time. And so I was able to freeze frame them and get them really quite clear. And very early episode, maybe 4 or 5, they're talking about shield failing, and there's, two words flashing on the screen. And they said, I wonder if that's shield failure. And I just looked really quick, and it's like, okay, well, the third letter in shield is I, All right. Oh, look, that would be the I in failure. Okay, well, that actually tracks. And so then that would be S-H-I-E-L-D-F. And then from there, I just went looking for other letters and then numbers. And sure enough, there's enough straight ones that you can find that you can reverse engineer the funny ones.
Yeah. That's cool.
And also, sometimes they'd have in Beast Wars, they'd have just big blocks of text scroll by, and sometimes those were just the alphabet in order. That also makes it a lot easier. Although they kept them small, so that kind of gives you an idea of the general shape of the letter, and then you look for another one where you can see that letter more clearly, and you say, oh, okay, that's what's going on here.
It helps when the Rosetta Stone scrolls by.
Like, oh, it does. Yeah. It certainly does. And the nice thing about, or maybe the interesting thing about that, is the Maximal and Predicon languages, they're both just straight, you know, Roman character substitution fonts, but they're so different from each other. The Maximal is all squares and half circles, and it's very sort of computery. But the Predicon looks like a handwritten language. It's got lots of serifs. It's sort of very jagged and violent. And I thought that was clever that they did that.
Hmm.
Jagged and violent, like most of Waspinator's deaths. I can see that.
First episode, so it was something that they'd done when they were making the pilot.
So, tell me, I'm thinking, like, so you're helping out with the fandom, you're involved. How does that transition into, you know, what you guys are doing now?
Well, yeah, I think I started to tell the story and got sidetracked, but I'd been a part of the fandom and tried to contribute. And one of the areas that I became very interested in was animation models. I saw scans of the old.
Can I stop you a moment?
Go for it.
He gets involved in animation models because Jim collects every one of the toys, and then he deciphers all the fonts, and he just kind of goes through these like little areas where he finds one aspect of a fandom. And then he just consumes all of it and then moves on to the next part of it. So at this point, he had like every G1 toy. He had all this artwork, and it just kind of led up to this point where he was collecting these animation models.
Wow. That's fair. And I'd found online scans of the Megatron Laserdisc box set. And they had the Convoy box set, the Laserdisc box set, then the 2010 and Headmasters. They had four of them. And then unfortunately, they stopped. They didn't keep it up with Master Force or Victory. But they had these booklets called Planet of Cybertron, and they had and in those booklets, they'd start with a picture of the back of the box art, and then you'd go through, and they'd have some trivia about the episodes, and then in the back they had all these animation. I didn't really know what they were, and I, at the time, I didn't read any Japanese, so I couldn't even read it. I just thought they were this really neat black and white artwork with the turnarounds of the characters and the headshots and sometimes the transformation. I said, oh, these are really cool, these production designs. Didn't know what they were, and I started trying to figure it out, and first I just looked for the other laser discs, and then eventually I was able to figure out enough to say, okay, well, that's what they are. They're the animation models, and I started trying to track those down, and I wound up getting on eBay. I wound up splitting with Fumihiko Akiyama, who's this sort of Japanese super fan, really nice guy. He doesn't come out to the States as much as he used to because of, you know, sort of family reasons. He has kids now, which I can sympathize with. I have a 5-month-old. But he and I wound up sort of splitting this Transformers comic Bible that we bought that had lots and lots of the animation models because they had shared the work that sort of had been done for Sunbow and Marvel was sort of done in many cases. It was sort of the same work, and for the animation models, those wound up going to the Marvel artists for reference. And it was just about everybody from the first probably two, three years. I think it was about the first 2.5 years. They were missing a bunch of the movie stuff, unfortunately. But in fact, I think a lot of the movie characters in the that we wound up using in the ARC books came from scans of the laser discs, as it turns out. But I tracked down all these animation models, and I said, I really want to share these. And I had spoken to Bill. Bill was the art director over at the Intrepid Sea Air Space Museum in New York, so he sort of had firmly established his credentials as an art type person and said, oh, you know, maybe we should, you know, try and put these up on the web or something. And Bill's like, you know, we could do it as a book. And we pitched it to, you know, we cleaned up some of the images and we made a 5-page pitch to IDW, and we approached them at one of the bot cons and said, hey, would you guys like to do a, you know, 100, 200 page book of black and white, you know, designs? And they said, no, why would we want to? That doesn't seem like a good idea. So we went back to the drawing board and we refined the pitch a little bit, but I think the big thing we did was I think Bill alluded to this. I went through a phase, and I still do this a little bit, where I was collecting a lot of the original artwork, and I had a few pieces from Don Figueroa, who was really hot in this time frame, and I contacted him and said, hey, you know, we're doing this project. You know, do you think maybe you could do, you know, a cover for us, you know, like a sort of a spec cover for us for this project? And he wound up doing that, and it's the cover that we used for the book, and we repitched it. You know, again, we made the pitch a little better, but mostly we had this beauty, and Bill colored it in this beautiful Don Figueroa cover, and that was enough for them to sort of take us seriously enough to give us that book deal.
Nice.
And that was very well received by the fans and had strong sales, and that's turned into, you know, what are we up to? About 7 or 8 books that we've done together collaboratively now.
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah, 7. Legacy of the Art of Transformers packaging will be the 7th book. You got
Seven,
Arc 1 and 2.
and I've done a couple more with Hasbro, and Bill's done some work
Yeah.
with Hasbro with IDW.
Yeah. Very cool.
Neat.
Which, of course, when we first hatched this plan to put these character models together, I think the first night we came up with this idea, one of us said, you know what we should do is take all that airbrushed artwork from the packaging and put them into a book.
I think we had that conversation very, very, very early on. And in fact, I think that was the second book we pitched to IDW, and we actually had had a tentative yes, and then we hit the wall with Hasbro and we said, hey, we'd love to do this book. How much art do you have? And they said, none.
So in a sense, we've been working on Legacy since about what, 2005?
I think maybe 2008.
Okay.
It'd be more apropos if it was 2005. You know that, right?
Yeah, well, it'd be less accurate. I think we first pitched this book around 2006. I think that's when we first pitched IDW, the art book.
What I like the most is that, you know, you put the book out, and then, I don't know, Jim comes across more art, and he says, you know what? I'm going to put this out on my website.
Well, I'm glad you like that.
Yeah, I love your
I
blog. It's
mostly.
awesome.
Thanks. I, you know, and I pretty much have shared it all, which is why I haven't done an update in about 3 months. That and the baby, but yeah, I've pretty much got all the Transformers stuff. I have a tiny bit of Transformers animation models that I haven't shared yet, that I'm still waiting for a good venue for, but not too much. I mean, most of the sort of backgrounds and stuff I have, that's all shared. I wish I had everything, but you know. It's still hard to find. And I every time I go to a Transformers convention, I always do a pass through the dealer's room looking for that sort of material.
Do you ever find anything?
Yeah, sure, sometimes.
Every once in a while?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find, but it's not impossible. I did a I think an 8-part series on Web World and maybe five-part series on another one of the season 3 episodes, maybe 6 parts. But that was stuff that I had gotten the model packs for specific episodes, and that was long after I'd gotten most of the rest of it. Some of it, like the backgrounds and whatnot, that I had gotten while I was still working on the second arc book, and a little bit of it makes its way into the complete arc. You know, we had a few extra pages, so we made sure that we filled those up with some extras. But most of it wasn't. I think it's really interesting blog fodder, but most of it wasn't sort of the kind of thing that would really be exciting in a book. A few of them were. I think we had the models for the crashed Decepticon ship that they used as their base in season 2, and I think, you know, we gave that a page or two in the complete arc, and that was really neat. That was some background stuff, but most of the background sort of material we had just wasn't quite at the level that we thought was appropriate for a book. And also, we always, I mean, every book we've ever worked on, we've pretty much run into our page counts. You know, we always have a little more than we have room for, which is a good thing to have. It means you wind up cutting the fat and making a stronger book. You know, I don't think we've ever had a book where we just had to fill space.
No.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's really good stuff. And again, if there's extras that can, you know, bleed over onto the website, then hey, that's just gravy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in some ways what we're doing is almost academic. It's almost like research. You know, we're trying to track down the material, find it, understand it, and then make sure it's published and then share it. And we like to go through IDW or Fun Publications because it helps us reach a wider audience. And it's frankly, it's just a nicer format, but some material doesn't make sense for that format. And that material, you know, if we're legally and ethically allowed to, sometimes people give us material with conditions attached. But if that's not the case, then I'm more than happy to share it on the blog.
Cool. So you must have a massive toy collection then.
You know, it's not as big as it used to be. It's been shrinking a little bit. I have all the G1 toys pretty much. There's a few sort of in G2 I'm not as complete. I didn't get all the repaints from G2. I mostly focused on original molds. But but I think it was G1, G2, the Japanese stuff. I think the European stuff I had most of, but that was right around when I was starting to lose interest a little bit. So I might have one or two gaps in there. And then I think I have almost all the mini cons. There might be a couple of the sort of really hard to find ones from Japan that I was missing. But a lot of the other stuff I had collected, and then I said, I don't know. Like Beast Wars. I was really into Beast Wars. I really like the toys. I still kind of do, but I only have finite space. So I think eventually those wound up on the chopping block. And I haven't been getting so many newer toys, even though they're quite nice. Just I just wonder where I can stop. You know?
I feel your pain. You know?
What about you, Bill? What kind of toys do you have as far as Transformers goes?
For many years, I just went crazy and just bought anything and everything. And recently, in the last couple of years, I've been really, really smart with it. And I said, you know, this is what I care about. This is all I'm going to collect. I'm going to get rid of everything else. So really, the only two things I collect are Seekers and Micromasters. And outside of that, there's one or two pieces floating around. But mostly, I keep to that just because I need the limitations. I have a very obsessive personality and will bankrupt me, and I will literally drown in toys. So I like having those parameters.
It's funny you say that your favorite is the Seekers, because we should introduce you to our mutual friend Brad Thorzine. He has the largest Seeker collection I've ever seen.
Really?
It's amazing.
Yeah. He has all the originals. He has every single knockoff you can think of.
I don't know if I have any knockoffs. I might have some knockoffs of the world's smallest, but that's about it.
Yeah.
He's got all the knockoffs. He's got a lot of the Japanese toys, I have a pretty sizable collection, but the Japanese figures are something that I really didn't get into until like Beast Wars Neo. So a lot of the G1 stuff, a lot of the Zone, all the you know the Japanese Micromasters, I don't have any of those, but they are really neat though. Thorzine's got a pretty extensive collection of that Japanese stuff. It's cool
to
see.
He does. He very much does. I'll try to see if I can find some pictures to show you guys.
And the other thing I like to collect is I'm kind of a little bit big into army building, which is why I found G.I. Joe very appealing recently. And Transformers has been getting better at it. So that I can reasonably justify army building in my mind, I'll usually get two or three of them. So that's kind of fun. So the most recent one was the Viacons from Prime.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Which are the only Prime toys I have, but they're quite nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want to say in Japan, they were army building mini-cons. They would just release them recolors and just...
I don't know if that's technically... I mean, army building usually is when you buy multiples of the same figure. And I usually only do that if there are multiples of the same figure in the fiction somewhere.
Right.
I think there's lots of avid mini-con collectors. I just don't know if I'd quite call them, you know, army builders, unless somebody just With the exception for me, I did army build on the dead end figure that came with Unicron because those are his antibodies. He's got tons of them. Actually, you can see my Unicron antibodies on the Transformers Wiki on the army building page. Actually, most of those are mine.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, we don't have. I want to say, well, the Viacons, but aside from the Viacons, there really isn't like a generic Cobra soldier. Like from the early lines, where it's just like a guy in a blue uniform with a mask. You know, we don't have the equivalent of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, probably the closest you'd have in G1 Transformers would be the Insecticons. And I guess you could probably Scourge, too, with the sweeps.
Or the Sharkticons.
Sharkticons. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I forgot about them. Yeah, so there's a few.
There's a few.
I've seen people army build Sharkticons, and it is creepy.
Yeah. Well, the Sharkticons themselves, along with their Quintesson masters, are also creepy.
I've armed Sharkticons. I think one of the great tragedies is probably overstating it, but for the purpose in this scope, the great tragedies of the Transformers Generation 1 line was that they never made the Alicon toys that the Quintessons used, just the Sharkticons, because I thought those were really neat. I'd have loved to have, and I think there's some third parties of them now, but I would have loved, you know, a classic toy back in the day of that. I would have been all over that.
He was supposed to reciprocate. Not now. Oh, boy. All right. So, Bill, who is, out of every single aspect of Transformers, who is your favorite character and why?
Oh, Starscream. Easily Starscream. I'll tell you the story of how I got my first Starscream, and you'll appreciate why I like Starscream. When I was a kid, my parents went out and they bought me Thundercracker. And they came back and they gave me Thundercracker. And I said, oh, I really want Starscream. And my mom got kind of annoyed that she went out of her way to buy me a toy, and I didn't appreciate it. And she didn't understand what I was asking for. And I said, I want the red one. And my mom said, why do you need the red one? And my father turned to her and said, your son likes the jerk, and the red one's the jerk, because your son relates to jerks. And I said, oh, okay, that's why I like him. So I like Starscream because he's a jerk, because he's – very, he has a lot of character to him.
Outside of G1 and Chris Latta's performance, who is your favorite version of Starscream?
Oh, I really like animated.
I gotta tell you, he's great, but I gotta tell you, I was really impressed with Prime Starscream. I think he has one of the most interesting Starscream story arcs of any Starscream that we've seen. He really comes full circle, and in such an organic way. It's a lot of fun for me to watch.
Yeah, Steve Bloom really knocked it out of the park. When we interviewed him a couple of years ago, we asked him, do they ever allow him to go into a Latta impersonation? And he said that, they don't do that often because they want to be my own thing. But when they do that in the booth, everybody throws up jazz hands, and he knows to go into Latta. I agree with you, Jim. I do like Starscream and Prime. It's probably the first time I've ever really truly liked and enjoyed Starscream. G1, I liked him as a kid, but not so much as an adult. I don't know what it is about the guy. I don't know. Maybe I just don't like jerks. I don't know why I podcasted for almost 5 years with Michael Wilson here then, if that's the case. No. So, Jim, what about you? Who is yours out of all of the anything. It doesn't have to be the cartoons. It doesn't have to be – it can be anything.
Probably Emusa then.
Who?
You know, Kane's little talking like bird bunny sort of thing from Zone.
Oh. Yeah,
can I change my answer?
Oh, that thing. Yeah. Oh, Moon. Oh, okay.
No, not Moon. Emusa. No. It's totally different. Moon, I thought, was a jerk. Not a jerk like Starscream jerk. Just like, why am I watching this guy?
Did Emusa?
But Artemis is cool. I liked Artemis. She was... No, I guess I'd say probably Shockwave. Shockwave is the character I respond to. especially the Furman and Buddy Yansky written Shockwave from the comics.
Mm.
Have you been reading the current IDW stuff?
Oh, of course.
That has to be the best origin of Shockwave I've ever seen.
Hey, spoilers. I haven't read the most recent
I
one.
Didn't say anything.
Thanks a lot.
Just said it's probably the best origin of Shockwave I've ever
now
seen.
Now we know that Shockwave has an origin. He didn't just like spring full grown from Zeus's brow or anything.
Well, I mean, you mean like aside from like Senator Shockwave or...
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay, yeah, I read those. I thought
see,
maybe like
those.
At the end of Dark Cybertron they.
Oh
like,
no!
Revelation
never,
or something.
No,
that
I would not. No. I'm talking about back when we find out Senator.
Right. Okay.
Not Dark. Why would I spoil Dark Cybertron for you? Come on now.
Honestly, I think a lot of the writing from IDW has really introduced some of the most inventive Transformers backstory stuff that I could. I've ever seen, like Emperada. It's like, why do these weird, you know, Transformer guys have one big eye and claw hands? That makes absolutely no freaking sense. They made the reason for it, and it flows. It works perfectly. It's amazing.
I think inventive is probably the exactly correct word. No, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, they're not constrained by preconceived notions, and they right. go back and re-examine some of the fundamentals.
Right. And you know, I hate to go back to like the Dreamwave stuff, but you know, back in the day, it was really cool to get G1 art because there wasn't any G1 art. It was like floating around. It was like this is amazing. It may be a little blocky. It may be a little too overly detailed, but it's G1 stuff. This is really cool. But the stories were awful. It was just they were just real. The writing was terrible. It was just I shouldn't say terrible. It was just more of the same. It was look, Autobots and Decepticons are fighting again. You know, okay, well that's great, but IDW has really shown us what can happen when you become inventive. This is like Marty Eisenberg level inventive. You know,
I think that was right baked into the DNA of IDW from the first or the zeroth episode issue, if you will, mm-hmm. because. I think Furman, in rebooting the universe, really went back and put some thought into, well, why are they doing it? Why are they on Earth looking like cars? And then the whole infiltration protocols and those sort of aspects of the stories, even those, I think, are very inventive and quite a big, if subtle, departure from what had gone before. And I rather enjoyed that.
Mm.
I jumped on board with More Than Meets the Eye. I was like, okay, Rodimus I know, Ultra Magnus I know, everybody else I'll learn about, and hey, we're not just going to stay on a dying planet, we're going to just leave. This is the best thing James Roberts could have ever done to those characters is make them leave.
and then make everyone think they were dead.
Yeah.
Well, you know, honestly, the writing there, it's one thing to say, yeah, they're all going to go on a quest, but the intrapersonal, you know, the bickering, yeah. the witty banter going on is amazing. The writing is, I can't tell you how much I love this stuff.
I think in order for it to be intrapersonal, it would have to be like a headmaster arguing with himself.
I think they've done that. Yeah.
So. Okay.
All right. So let's go behind the scenes a little bit. Now, be honest. Have you ever called up or called upon one of the voice actors to nail a line of dialogue from one of the books?
No.
Yeah, no.
That question, I don't know. I mean, you got to remember, we mostly do art books.
Right, but, well, with Allspark Almanac, that was story-driven.
And we interviewed a lot of voice actors for Allspark.
Oh, and I interviewed. We got to speak to all of the main voice actors and some of the guys playing secondary characters in animated. But I don't think it ever occurred to me to have them go through the lines that we'd written.
No. What I'm saying is more like, you know, you might see a line from Starscream in animated, and you might not get it translated so well, and like you would ask them, is this the way that you would say it in that voice? That kind of thing.
Oh, not to the voice actors, but, you know, Marty Eisenberg and Matt Youngberg and Derek Wyatt went through every, I mean, they had full drafts of each of those books, and they gave us their notes and feedback. And especially on the first one, Marty, I mean, they all did, but I think Marty especially had quite a bit of feedback for us.
Yeah.
So if the voices are ringing true, it's because we had help from the writers and then the artists and creators responsible, but not as much the voice actors, partially just because the voice actors, we tended to do half hour interviews that were sort of very scheduled, whereas we had a much more back and forth relationship going on with Matt and Marty and Derek.
I remember us getting a note back from Marty at one point where we had Optimus Prime use a certain word, and he said, Optimus Prime would never use Yiddish. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think so. The note that stuck with me was about Lugnut, and he'd circled our Lugnut dialogue, and he said, it's close, but it needs, he has to work in a praise for Megatron, even if he's not talking about Megatron, because that's how he thinks. So we said, okay, we can do that. So even if I don't remember which off the top of my head which characters Lugnut speaks on, but if Lugnut is talking about Swindle, he still has to do it in a way where he's giving glory and respect to Megatron.
He's praising Megatron. If I remember right, back when the AllSpark Almanac came out, we spoke with, I think we had an interview with
it was
Derek Wyatt.
It was with Jim.
Yeah, and he was Derek Wyatt.
Oh,
we did talk to Derek Wyatt.
Did we?
Yeah, but I didn't speak with Jim. I thought we spoke with Derek
that was
Wyatt
the
around the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and anyway, he was telling us about how he was collaborating with you guys.
Yeah, I mean he more than Matt and Marty had their input, and it was invaluable, and we definitely appreciated it. But I think Derek was the one who really, spent lots and lots of time with us on those books. Would you agree, Bill?
I would definitely agree. We'd go up to his office, and we spent a great deal of time going over things, and he very much holds it very close to his heart.
Wow. See, that would be awesome. I don't think
he's a lot of fun. I mean, you interviewed him, so you know.
Yeah, he's great. I actually met him at a BotCon
this year, so you can. I'm pretty sure he's going to be at BotCon this year, so you can go up and say hi to him now too.
Yeah, he still visits even if he's not like on a panel.
He lives in the LA region, so when BotCon, California.
Yeah. Now that it's only in California anymore, grumble, grumble.
Grumble, but every time it's in California, we get tons of writers, we get tons of voice actors.
Tons of actors.
Not having to fly them in, just having to pay their appearance fee, makes it so much more economical to have really, really good guests.
Now, I understand the reason. I'm just tidally locked in the Midwest, I'm just kind of stuck here, nowhere near California, so.
Yeah, but I mean, you're not really all that near to, where exactly are you?
Chicago.
Okay, so it's not like if they hold it in Florida, it's appreciably closer to you, or Dallas.
Yeah,
you're still fine.
But I get the benefit of going to Disney World while I'm there.
Okay, so. LA has tons to do. Los Angeles is one of the greatest cities in the world. If you can't find something to do in LA, it's not something wrong with the city, my friend.
Yeah, it's definitely me. You can only go to Santa Monica Pier so many times. No. I met Jim what was the last BotCon I went to? Was it
2010?
It was weird too, because we just happened to be standing next to each other at a table, and you were looking at something, and I was looking at something, and we ended up talking.
And yeah, I do that a lot.
Yeah. It didn't occur to me who you were. I was like, this is tall guy. But and after the fact, when I saw your name tag, I was like, holy crap, that was Jim Sorensen. Shit, I could have asked him all these things, and I had no idea that was him.
Well, I made it easier to find me, because for the past 3 or so years, I've been walking around with a cowboy hat on, so it's not hard to find me at cons anymore. Not that it was ever that hard, but now it's like you can spot me from across the room. So anybody who wants to come up and ask me a question or chat with me or something, just feel free. And by the way, this is only partially an affectation. Partially it's for health reasons. My doctor told me to start wearing hats when I had a few not so great cells on the bridge of my nose. So I actually have a medical excuse for my affectation.
There you go.
But cowboy hat, that was my choice.
You could just tell people that you were copying Scott McNeil and everybody would be cool with it.
I don't actually want to be caught. I mean, Scott McNeil is awesome, but I feel like a little weird if I'm just like emulating him.
Oh, I wouldn't.
Good to know.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you could do worse than try to be like Scott McNeil, I guess. I suppose.
That's true.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, no, that was very cool. And I never got a chance to say, hey, it was cool to talk with you. Yeah. It was just kind of this weird thing.
I'm a legitimately friendly person, and I love going to cons and striking up conversations with random people. So,
what about you, Bill? How was your con experience?
I enjoy going to cons. I'm just not a socialist, Jim, which I'm sure you've picked up on by this conversation. But I tend to be a little quieter, so I'm usually about 10 feet behind Jim, just minding my own business. but
actually,
I'm the guy
comes into his own where Bill comes into his own at the cons, I think, is in the bar scene afterwards. I mean, I enjoy it, but I think Bill really flourishes there. And that's where he sort of opens up and gets a chance to chat with the fans and creators.
Oh, yeah, if I'm drunk, then yeah, absolutely. Drunk?
There you go.
Wow.
It's like, hey, look, it's Bill singing karaoke. Awesome.
I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Oh.
Now all I can imagine with the two of you is Jim is Scott Farkas and Bill is the other kid.
We had somebody point out to us that our personalities are very much like Tigger and Eeyore.
Eeyore.
I think that's pretty accurate.
You could do worse than Peter Cullen.
Yeah, right, sure.
Thanks for noticing me. I was at the BotCon where he announced that he was no longer Eeyore. And everybody was like, "Oh," and he's like, "Thanks for noticing me." He's like, "I've just been told I'm no longer Eeyore." It's like, oh, wow, that's terrible. I mean, why
would you get rid of him?
I don't know.
Why? I mean, honestly, it's like if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
So, Bill, you want to tell us about your television debut and the fact that you have an official Hasbro licensed tattoo on your body?
I think it might be the only official Hasbro licensed tattoo. the story goes, I forget when it was, but quite a few years ago, I was on a website or a forum or something, and I was talking to somebody about getting a Transformers tattoo, and I think it was a tattoo forum, and somebody contacted me and said, you should fill out this form for LA Inc., which is this reality show where they give you tattoos, which I was familiar with. So I went and I filled out the form. Like a year later, they came back to me and they said, what Transformer? Can you send us an image? Can you tell us anything about this? So by then, we were working on the second arc book. So I sent them Nick Roche's cover that Josh Bertram colored of Victory Leo. And I said, yeah, I'm interested in getting this done. And they wrote me back and said, well, can you get Hasbro to approve this? And I said, I don't know. How the hell do I do that? So I contacted IDW, who contacted Hasbro, who contacted me, and it went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And they had to draw up a licensing agreement, and they had to speak to a bunch of lawyers. But eventually they got back to me and they said, yes, you can do it. And I contacted LA Inc. and I said, yes, I can do it. And they said, well, it's too late. So I said, oh, okay. So close to a year goes by, and they start filming for the following season. And they contacted me and said, can we do it now? So Hasbro agreed, and I went down there, and I did like a screen test. And believe it or not, they actually liked me. So they said, okay, we're going to do it on the show, and we're going to tattoo your chest on the show. So come down a certain day, and I come down a certain day, and they introduce me to everybody, and then they have me walk outside the building and then pretend to walk in and meet everybody on camera.
Right.
And for the, I don't know, 6 or 7 minutes I'm on screen, I was actually sitting in that chair for, I was actually there all day, but I was in that chair for about 6 hours getting that tattoo.
Wow.
So
it
took a long time. Yeah. What they would do is they put rubber bands on the machine so it would lower the sound of the machine. Mm-hmm. And he would like almost kind of just like fill in areas and talk to me. And then they say, okay, we're turning the cameras off. And then they turn the cameras off and the machines would get louder. And I'd go, oh my God, my chest. Ah.
So, don't weep openly while the cameras are on, please.
Yeah, then they'd go, okay, we'll turn the cameras back on. And I would just kind of like get my composure. You know? So what got me about it is you know, they interview me beforehand and they asked me a bunch of Transformers questions and I answered as nerdy as possible. And I'm dropping names and I'm giving them references and I'm telling them stories and all this other stuff. And apparently it was too nerdy for them. So when it aired, they had cut down all my dialogue so that questions like, why did you choose this Transformer? Instead of the long-winded answer I gave, just came out like, well, he's a robot. And just kind of came up as me being a dumbass. But ultimately it was a fun experience. Painful experience, but a fun experience.
Yeah, well, you know, it gets you on TV. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, I get recognized for it every once in a while still to this day.
Wow.
I think it's kind of bizarre that Bill actually has a licensed tattoo because I've never heard of that before.
And I don't know if you've seen the tattoo, but it's giant, it's on my chest, and it's bright orange. So my girlfriend loves it.
Oh, that's funny. You know, what's weird is lately, in the last couple of years, at like comic conventions, you see a lot more of tattoo artists showing up. And not just, you know, just to show up the show their wares, where they've actually got a booth where they do tattoos.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, well, in Chicago, at least.
Oh, I'll see that, but that's great. That's cool.
And not that I'd get one, but because I'm
it's definitely a crossover there. I mean, we're into a very visual hobby, and same with comic books and superheroes or G.I. Joe or not just Transformers. It only makes sense that it would carry over into the tattoo world.
Yeah,
that's true.
But they're usually pretty jumping. My wife's like, hey, you want to go get a tattoo? And I'm like, no. And it's not just because I'm afraid of needles. You know, it has more to do with I'm just not sure if I care about any one particular thing to have it permanently scarred into my body.
I think you got to be of a certain mindset to get one. Mm. Yeah, I just think it's either part of your personality or it's not part of your personality.
Mm. I think I'm unique enough.
Yeah. For me, I don't think so. I need to advertise.
Yeah, you can't. Oh, you can't throw a rock.
I can just see Bill now with his right arm sleeve. Transformers Legacy. Go buy it now. Coming down his entire arm.
That would, you know, honestly though, I think if I had 7 Transformers books under my belt, I would probably have the like the covers blended in, you know, on a sleeve. How cool would that be? There's an idea for you.
Yeah, maybe
I should. I gotta go back to
run that one by Jill.
What's that?
I said run that one by Jill.
See what she says. They're just expensive. Right. Tattoos are pricey.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Especially if you want to take one.
A couple thousand on that sleeve.
Yeah. Do either one of you guys have any crazy or interesting fan experiences that you might have had over the years going to BotCon? Any weird requests or anything like that?
I got to sign a girl's boob once.
Who hasn't?
Must have been fun.
I've had a couple of people, usually younger people, after the Almanacs came out, get very excited over meeting me, and it became very strange and unusual because, you know, quite frankly, I get a couple of Transformers books, and to be treated in any sort of like I've been in a movie or something is very uncomfortable and very weird. But I've had a couple of experiences where one time I was at a convention and this kid came over and started talking to me over a toy I was looking at. I forget what it was, but for whatever reason, let's say it was Whirl, and I was looking at a Whirl. And he came over and said, "Well, such and such and such, this will be in the next All-Spark Almanac." And I said, "Oh, no, it won't be." And he said, "How do you know?" I said, "Because I wrote them." And the kid reaches up and grabs my name badge, which was turned up backwards, and he turns it around and sees my name, and he just flips out on me. "Oh, my God, oh, my God, I have so much questions. I have to ask you this, I have to ask you that." And it was so uncomfortable and so weird that I just tried to get the hell out of there. So little things like that happen once in a while. But I don't know if we have any really crazy stories, though. Jim, you got anything?
Other than my boob signing, not particularly. I mean, I tend to go to network and to chat with fans and to promote the work and to, you know, hunt for toys and artwork. And yeah, I tend to mostly do that. I mean, not a whole lot very strange has happened.
Oh, I might have a good one. After the tattoo thing, I kind of came up with this idea that I was going to try to do more publicity nonsense, you know? And I went and I took a Cobra Commander action figure when we had the G.I. Joe books coming out. And I attached it to a camera and I launched this thing into space. And put it on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and type Cobra Commander space, you'll see this action figure.
I've seen that.
Okay, that was me.
I didn't realize that was you. How cool.
So I did this, and some guy that I know who's a weirdo, and long story behind him, but a guy named Peter I know, who's a really great guy, but he's a very strange guy, comes to me and he says, what are you going to do next? So me joking said, "I'm going to take a Transformer to the top of Mount Everest." And the next thing I know, he's writing to me and he says, "Can it be Erector? Can you take Erector to the top of Mount Everest?" So I don't know if you know anything about Mount Everest, but it's really expensive and really difficult to climb. So I said, I'll tell you what, if you pay for it, I'll climb. You get $100,000 to climb Mount Everest. I will go climb Mount Everest and put an Erector on the summit.
There you go. You'll put it next to the dead bodies of people who, you know, couldn't make it back down and they can't afford to bring them down.
And the next thing I know, this guy is making me logos for the trip. And there's this logo of me standing on top of Mount Everest holding an Erector above my head. And he's in Sweden, I believe, trying to raise money now.
This is what Kickstarter was made for.
Go to www.kickstarter.com.
There you go.
So while I sincerely doubt I'm ever going to climb Mount Everest, don't be surprised if you see me climb something and put an Erector on the top of it.
You know, Empire State Building, Statue of Liberty.
Something.
You know, you may not make it to Everest, but you can go to Paris. You know, I can see that.
Maybe if I find a much smaller mountain.
There's some nice sized mountains out in L.A., right?
Or you could just, you know, go to the top of Willis Tower.
The Willis Tower. I'm going to take Erector and put him on the edge.
And then looking down.
That's right. You're not afraid of heights, are you, Erector?
All right. Would you like to inform the fans where they can interact with you online, Jim?
Sure. Probably still the best place remains my blog at boltax.blogspot.com. And you can also email us at transformerstheark@yahoo.com.
All one word?
What about? Yeah. I would assume. All one word.
I'm just asking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
What about you, Bill?
Well, you can look for me on Twitter or Facebook under Bill Forster. I also have a website with my artwork on it called BillForster.com. And that's F-O-R-S-T-E-R. And while it is filled with ponies right now, soon there'll be some more Transformers stuff on it. So.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, check that out.
Yeah.
Or go to BotCon and look for the guy in the cowboy hat.
I'll be the guy standing behind him.
He'll be the guy standing immediately behind him. Yeah. Yeah.
No, the guy standing 10 feet behind him.
Wow. You know, those aisles aren't that big. It's kind of hard, you know, to stay that close.
Well, you know, Jim could have, you know, flashed his celebrity badge and got to the front of the line, and Bill is standing at the back of the line.
Yeah, I don't
get a celebrity badge.
That never worked for me. But no, I'm not a celebrity. Well, there you go.
Exactly.
But no, it's very cool. I just wanted to throw it out there that, you know, it's the story here that you guys have told is that you're big fans, and or at least, you know, Jim, big fan and collectors, you know, of the toys and such. But you made your you know, your fandom work for you, and you have you know, made something really, really cool out of it. And you know, gotta give you guys you know, applause for that.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, I mean, 7 amazing art books.
Yeah.
That's just awesome. Really, really is. And what I was saying earlier about the voices and stuff. Like every time I read the Allspark Almanacs, I can hear the characters in my head as I'm reading those stories. I'm like, I can hear Sentinel pontificating as he always does.
I have to say, Sentinel Prime is far and away my favorite character from Transformers Animated. I just fell in love with him. He's just fantastic. And I think what I really regret about the fourth season, and I think many people were very upset there wasn't a fourth season, and I think I was less so because I thought the third season really did quite a good job of wrapping up almost all the loose ends. But what I regret missing out on is the idea of the administration of Cybertron by Sentinel Magnus. I really wanted to see that, and you know, we got to see a little bit of it, but we would have gotten to see a whole lot more, and that would have been a lot of fun.
I just wanted season 4 for the proposed Dark Glass, Shattered Glass episode they were going to do, and to make sure that Rodimus was still alive.
I thought that Shattered Glass Sentinel Prime should be a headmaster.
Oh, wow. That would be a change.
The real, real organic partnership.
Yes. Yes, it would be.
Very nice.
All right. Well, we would like to thank Mr. Sorensen and Mr. Forster for taking the time to chat with us here in this All Things Transformers interview. We'll ask you to hold the line, and we'll be back after this.
Hi, this is Bill Forster, and you are listening to All Things Transformers.
So, Jim and Bill, what can you tell us about the new book you have coming out?
I'm sorry, we're not allowed to share any details about the book.
Oh, I understand. Damn lawyers.
No, let's see. It's going to be a 300-page volume. It's going to be oversized. So if you guys have seen the Art of Prime that I did back in November or so, or I think December, actually, it's going to be
beautiful.
That size. Really large. Well, what are the dimensions, Bill? About what, 12 and a half by 9.5, something like that?
Roughly about that.
That's per page. So the two-page spreads are just absolutely stunning. The book covers all of G1. All of G2, the U.S. G2, all of the U.S. G1, and then all the Japanese stuff from G1 as well. And in terms of completion, it's not 100%, but it's real close. It's maybe 95, 96% of what's out there we found. And most of the gaps tended to be pretty obscure. So there's a few missing Action Masters, a few missing from the tail end of G2, and a couple of Japanese guys. And that's it for what's missing. So and we're really proud of that because, you know, I think we alluded to earlier, Hasbro didn't have much of this material in their archives. When we first pitched the book, we kind of hoped that they would. We kind of assumed that they would. And they wound up being able to give us maybe 20, 30 images, something like that, including a couple of unused images, which were kind of neat. But they were missing a lot of just the core characters. So when we first pitched the book, we were working from scans, from laser discs and things like that. And over the course of putting it together, you know, we'd spent a couple of years on it, I think, off and on the back burner. But over the course of putting it together, we wound up finding fans and collectors and some professionals, some of the original artists that had worked on it, that had, you know, a few pieces here, a few pieces there, and also working with Takara through their design firm, which is called Part One. They do all the eHobby exclusives. And with, you know, combining all those different sources into something where we have virtually everything. And we almost never were able to work from a box scan. So these are scans from original artwork, scans from first generation transparencies, chromolins, scans from first generation photo negatives, that sort of thing. So the artwork is just amazingly crystal clear. There's no print artifacts, none of the character bits are cut off by anything. I mean, if you look at the actual package art, a lot of the time somebody's foot gets covered, somebody's arm runs off the page, and that just doesn't happen in this book. And I think we're really proud that we were able to find so many high quality sources.
That sounds fantastic. So, I mean, I haven't seen previews yet of the art, but what's the format in? I mean, is it like, is it just the picture of the character as appeared on the box, or is it like a picture of the box, or, you know, I've seen the boxes folded flat so you can see like the sides, things like that. I mean, what does it look like in the actual print?
It's the image itself in its entirety. It's like Jim was saying, it's not scanned from any boxes or anything, so it doesn't have the background of the box. However, we did do some backgrounds to it that kind of represent the box art and kind of give homage to that time period in the toy's history. However, some of the images might share a page with another character. Other images might stand alone. But effectively, we go through several chapters, I think 14 chapters, actually, and we break down, separate them by Autobot and Decepticon, and just kind of put the appropriate characters together with appropriate characters.
Nice. What Bill was alluding to about the backgrounds, one of the, and I think I made a Facebook post around this idea, but one of the joys and occasional frustrations of working collaboratively is that you can be surprised. And in this one, mostly what I did was locate the images and put them in the right context, you know, organize them, say who goes with who, what goes in what chapter. Bill did most of the heavy lifting in terms of cleaning up the images and laying out the images and putting them in the visual context. And when I first saw the book, what really struck me was how he said, you know, there's 14 chapters. Each one sort of covers a different era. So you have your classic era, the characters that were introduced in 1845, your movie era stuff, your Pretenders, your Micromasters, the various different Japanese eras. But each one has its own feel to it, its own background that sort of calls to mind the packages of those era.
Right.
And it makes the book have this wonderful sort of momentum. And it wasn't something I think I would have come up with. It wasn't the sort of idea that I would have had. So that's one of the joys of working with somebody else who has a different vision than you, but wants to accomplish the same things, is that you can look at your work and be surprised and pleased. And that definitely is something that happened around that aspect of the book. And I think it does a great job of capturing the feeling, the emotional feeling of looking at this artwork on a package without being a picture of the package, the artwork next to the toy and whatnot, but it feels like that. So right. you're like, you know, it's not just on a white background for the most part. I mean, the last chapter is we call oddities, and it's all the sort of stuff that didn't fit into neatly into one of our eras. So that's on a plain white background. And I think Pretenders wound up being on a plain black background because it worked really well for them. But for the most part, as you go through it, it's the background gives it such a nostalgic feeling. I was really proud's not quite the right word because it wasn't really my accomplishment, but I guess pride of authors it sort of to look at that. I was really impressed by that. And,
nice.
And actually, we broke the book into four rough parts, sort of overarching eras, and each part has a 2-page introduction where we sort of talk about put the artwork into context, and there we do show some pictures of packages and some scans of proof cards, and you mentioned having a box that's folded so you can see the flaps. We have that to also try and set the right context. So if you're reading the book, you know, I mean, it's an art book, so it's you're not mostly going to be reading it, but we did want to make sure, and that was some input from our editors at IDW. They wanted to make sure that there was that sort of context for someone that did want to actually learn more about it.
Right.
I think that was probably the correct decision because, you know, in the course of putting it together, we did sort of uncover some interesting facts, and I learned things about the process of how they did it and why they did it. And it's interesting to share some of that, I think. But mostly,
It's okay. I was just saying, speaking of reading an art book, Jim went and tracked down many of the artists that actually did these pieces. And we've got interviews and essays from them as well in the book. So you can also kind of get their perspective on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was really proud of that. We were able to find, I think we have nine of the original artists, 8 of them from the U.S., and one of them from Japan who'd done quite a lot of the illustrations behind it and got them to share their thoughts. And I was really proud of that because some of these names, many of these names aren't known at all to the Transformers fandom. So anytime you uncover something new, it's such a well-researched hobby. You know, you get a certain pride from that. But to not only find out who they were, but to get their direct input, I was really proud of that.
Nice. And that's the interviews are in the book?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, we use them sort of as chapter separator elements. So, you know, between each chapter, we'll have a nice 2-page spread of sort of the back of the package style artwork to sort of introduce it. And then we'll have 1 page of either, you know, an essay, an interview. Sometimes we'll have sketches or other sort of slightly askew elements, you know, these other elements. And then we start the chapter on the right-hand side of the page.
There's a lot of content. There's a lot of content in this book.
Well, it's 300 pages, and we use all 300.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is these interviews are kind of like what you guys did with the AllSpark Almanac, where you would have, like, Yatter and all these other little interesting things, but in this case, it's the interviews from these artists. That's really cool. That is an interesting way to separate the chapters.
I thought so. It gives it a visual break because the book is busy is not quite the right word, but the book has a lot. It's dense. That's the word. You know, there's a lot going on in the book. I mean, the essays tend to be on a plain white background, so it sort of gives your eye a bit of a break as you're going through this.
Nice. Yeah.
Very cool. Cleans your palate for the next chapter.
Yeah, that's always good.
Yeah.
Anything else we want to bring up about the book?
We could probably talk about the book for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah. No spoilers.
It's hard to spoil an art book because no matter how much we talk about an image, unless you're actually looking at it. Well, one of the things I thought was neat was, you know, we have 12 chapters where we go through the era of the various eras of artwork that was published. Like I said, all of G1, all of G2, from the US, and then the Japanese material. We couldn't really find, we had a little bit from the UK, but not a lot, not enough to warrant its own chapter. But the last two chapters, I mentioned that the last one, 14, is oddities, and there's a lot of neat stuff in there. But things like the UK artworks, a little bit of artwork from Diaclone and Microchange, some of the variants that had been used, some of the two-page spreads, some art from Japan. So all that stuff is kind of neat, a little bit of catalog artwork. But the 13th chapter is unused artwork, and that was stuff that was produced for the G1 or the G2 lines, but not actually used in a toy that came out. And that winds up being, a good, I want to say, maybe, 12 to 15 page chapter of
Cool.
artwork that wasn't used. And I thought that was just the neatest thing, to go through. I mean, a lot of it's from G2 because there were various toys that were developed for G2 and almost came out, but didn't quite. So things
Right.
like Decepticons and, new color variants of the Jets and the Diaclone cars and the Dinobots. But there's also some stuff from G1 that had come out, like on the MicroMaster Battlefield Headquarters from 1990. On the front of the package, you have the nice used picture of the truck sort of rolling with the two MicroMasters in it. But if you look really, really carefully on the back of the package, you'll see that they have the headshots of Full Barrel and Overflow, the two MicroMasters that came with it. And they're not the same as the headshots that were used in the artwork of the truck, of them driving the truck. And we actually, in the course of putting this together, this is something that that Rick Alvarez, who'd worked at Hasbro at the time, had dug up for us, found the actual full-bodied illustrations of these two MicroMasters that all you ever see in the package is their heads, but we have the whole thing. And it's elements like that I just think are that really help kind of push the book over the edge. I mean, it's already a very, I mean, people love this style of artwork. I love this style of artwork. I really respond to it emotionally. So it's neat just to have, if all we had was, 95% of this artwork in one place, that would be an accomplishment. But to also have stuff that was made in the 80s and in the 90s that was never used, stuff like the Full Barrel and Overflow bodies, stuff like a potential US release of Multiforce, stuff like the unreleased GoBots from G2, or the stuff that eventually got released as Spy Changers, but not for years, years and years and years, part of the Robots in Disguise line years later.
Right.
That sort of material, I mean, I'm just incredibly proud to have found that. And I think it really makes the book feel special, because a lot of the stuff I can guarantee you've never seen before because nobody's ever seen it before.
That sounds amazing. I know recently they had what resurface? It was like a Sears Christmas catalog from 1980, whatever year. I want to say whatever year, like the G2 stuff was coming out at the time. Maybe it was a little bit later, but they showed pictures of a lot of the stuff that hadn't come out yet, and the fandom was just flabbergasted, like just amazed. Like, wow, this was coming out, or these were the repaints of this was coming out. So I can only imagine what people are going to say when they get a hold of your book.
Oh
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty epic.
Yes,
Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to the reaction, certainly. One of the great joys of doing these books is to read the reviews on Amazon, to look at the forum posts about the book, and to be asked questions about it. I mean, it's definitely, we have to go on the podcast and talk about the upcoming projects because, we sort of have to sing for our supper and make sure that the books, that the people get the word that these books are coming out. We want to get the word out. But it's also very gratifying for us to have the opportunity to interact with somebody who enjoys the work and wants to know, why we did a certain thing or how we did a certain thing. That's a lot of fun for us.
Very cool. Very cool. We are, well, we're 2 years away from Beast Wars anniversary. Do you guys have any plans for a Beast Wars book?
Book number 8.
There you go.
Sorry, Bill, you can take this one.
We have plans for everything, is all I was saying.
Yeah, I mean, if you've had an idea for a Transformers art book, there's a pretty decent chance that we've at some point or other at least mentioned it to IDW. You know, the trick is there's basically three questions that have to be asked does the material exist, you know, in a way that we can get access to it? If the material doesn't exist, we can't do the book. You know, does it make commercial sense for IDW? Is it a book that if they publish, you know, people will buy in sufficient numbers to justify publishing it? And does it make strategic sense for Hasbro? So if the answer to those three questions are yes, there's a pretty good chance that that book can come out. And and really, those are things, the Hasbro question.
Jim, you cut out.
I think what he's saying is, over time, the answer to those three questions changes. You know, if we pitched something 2 years ago, it might be different this year, and it might be different 2 years from now. So 2 years from now, when we're looking at the anniversary of Beast Wars, who knows where we'll be? Certainly, we'll be there pitching the idea, but it's always a matter of what we can or can't do through IDW.
Right. Yeah. I personally would love to see a Beast Machines art book. I love Beast Machines.
I think a lot of the Beast Machines art would end up being, I don't want to say scans from the TV show, but I mean, if the original the original CGI art could be dug up, then that would be interesting. Package art would be interesting, but specifically now, I think we're seeing more. Beast Wars stuff show up in the toy line. You've got a Rat Trap coming out. You got Tankor coming out.
That's because they got shoehorned into the comic.
Well,
I still have no. I have to go back and read Dark Cybertron to figure out how the hell Waspinator, Rat Trap, and Tankor fit into Dark Cybertron. I still do not get it.
Do you think they showed up in the comic because there's a toy coming out, or do you think the toy coming out precipitated them showing up in the comic?
Probably both.
You know, these toys are on the drawing board years in advance.
Yeah. Jim, what were you gonna say?
I tend to think that you might be confusing cause and effect. I tend to think that if the toys are showing up in the comic, it's because the toy is coming out.
Yeah, that's true.
At least in those cases, there are definitely are cases of a character becomes popular in a comic or on a TV show and therefore gets a toy. But the lag time, you know, does tend to be a couple of years.
And 9 times out of 10, the toy is going to be making more money than the comic is, so that's what's going to drive it.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we appreciate you guys taking the time to talk with us, and we will catch you later.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
One more time!
All hail Starscream!
This is going to be juicy.
All right, there you go, folks. The interview with Jim Sorensen and Bill Forrester, it was amazing talking to those guys. It was a lot of fun.
It was great fun. Now, you know, like I said, Jim, I know of Jim, I've spoken with him, did not know of Bill, and I'm really happy that I got a chance to talk with him, and you know, I hit him up on Facebook.
Very cool.
Very nice guy.
Yeah, very, very awesome. The funny thing is, when I searched for, or when I was looking at the TF Wiki for both of them, because that's the best place that I could find for their actual information, because they're not on Wiki as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. The link that I found with Bill's tattoo actually goes back to Jim's blog, Disciples of Baltax.
Oh, that was a link you sent.
Yeah.
You'll have to put that link online too.
Oh yeah, I will most definitely put it in the post. Yeah.
Or we could just, you know, do a Google search for Baltax.
Yeah. You know,
tattoo.
All right, well, that's going to do it with this second interview for TFG1, All Things Transformers, all that good stuff. Second interview of the year so far. First time around, we talked with Abby Collins, so that was really, really awesome, talking to Starscream's daughter.
Oh.
Missed out on that one.
yeah, that sounds like a good time.
Yeah, no, it was hilarious. It was awesome. She told us stories of how basically Cobra Commander and Starscream were every time that her dad was going to discipline the kids.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, you'll have to listen
that
to it.
That must have been hell growing up. Can't imagine that.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to the TFG1 podcast, All Things Transformers interview of Jim Sorensen and Bill Forrester. Be sure to check out Transformers Legacy, the art of Transformers toy packaging, coming out soon from IDW Publishing. And we will catch you next time. Transform and roll out.
I love when a plan comes together.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.